welcome back. And we want to thank Mayor Joe Sullivan and Mayor Kay for being a part of our last segment. And we have actually a pretty cool segment coming up, Joe. We have joining us in studio Mr. Steve Roy. Mr. Roy is an expert in the field of the JFK, the John F. Kennedy assassination. Good evening, Mr. Roy. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks for having me on.
First and foremost, talk to us about your expertise in the assassination of one of our presidents going on 50 years ago, I would say, later on this week?
Well, it was of my generation. I was about 12 years old when it happened. I was in algebra class at West Junior High School, and I always was interested in it. I read the Warren Report when it came out, and I've always kind of followed it, always been interested in history. And I have gravitated over the years toward a specialty in a character named David Ferry, who was part of this. If you've seen the Oliver Stone film, it was the Joe Pesci character. But I've always had an interest in the Kennedy assassination in general, and I know more about it than most people.
And you're actually a person who is, when the anniversary of this incident took place, you're usually someone who's called in to kind of talk about it. You really have an in-depth knowledge to this situation that took place that will forever be a part of our country's history.
Sure. I've appeared on radio and TV and spoken at seminars and contributed to books and that sort of thing.
What's that like? Because you have been referenced in a number of books. I believe that there's probably a slew of books that are going to be coming out this year because of the 50th anniversary that
sure.
You are part of the bibliography or that you are referenced in some form or fashion, correct?
Yes.
What exactly, how did you specialize in a guy like a David Ferry who was somehow tied to Oswald, the individual who is, you know, who killed John F. Kennedy?
Well, a few years after the assassination, the New Orleans District Attorney, Jim Garrison, conducted an investigation, and one of his suspects was David Ferry. So I got interested at that point, and I started reading books and collecting little snippets of information. And I used to put them on index cards because there was not a lot pulled together on Ferry in any particular place. And then through happenstance, I was visiting an aunt in Louisiana, and she said that her next-door neighbor had something to do with that, and she introduced me to him. And the fellow's name was Al Boboff, and he was David Ferry's best friend. And from that, it just kind of blossomed to other things.
You know, from when you were a 12-year-old boy hearing this taking place to some of the stuff that you've probably heard, how many different theories have you heard over the years in regards to how JFK was shot, how the incident went down?
Oh, many. And at an anniversary like this, you hear a lot of them. You mentioned the books coming out this year. There are huge number of books. There have to be at least 50 or 100 books coming out this year alone, what with, you know, internet publishing and all that sort of thing. But there's many theories about it. They all tend to gravitate around four or five possibilities: that Oswald did it alone, that the CIA was involved, that the mafia was involved. But there are, in fact, many, many, many theories about it.
I have to ask, and that is, do we know what actually happened? The theory is that there were three bullets, but we've heard theories that there might have been somebody on the grassy knoll. As you know, there's always a conspiracy to something major that happens. I mean, what's your thought as to do we accurately know who killed JFK?
Well, you know, the what we call the Kennedy assassination research community, which I'm kind of a member of, is split up into basically two factions: the LNs, the lone nutters as they're called, and the CTs, the conspiracy theorists. If you're a CT, a conspiracy theorist, your point of view is, well, we don't know, maybe we'll never know, we have to find out. If you're a lone nutter, we already know who committed the assassination. That would have been Lee Harvey Oswald by himself.
Right. And he wasn't that old. I didn't really realize it. When you look at some of the video and the footage, you look at Lee Harvey Oswald, and he looks like he might be in his, you know, 30s, maybe early 40s. But I, you know, after doing a little further research and you and I having a little bit of a discussion, I didn't realize how young he was.
Yes, 24 years old at the time of the assassination.
So what we're going to do is we'll Let's play a little soundbite that you actually shared with us of kind of help us set up the sound cut. What is this?
Well, Lee Harvey Oswald had done several things in his 24 years. He had been in the Marine Corps. He defected to the Soviet Union, lived there for 3 years, came back with a Russian bride. And when he came back, he started petitioning for fair play for Fidel Castro and for Cuba. And so he appeared on radio programs, and he had little demonstrations handing out leaflets. And what we're about to hear is a clip from a radio program in New Orleans where he was talking about his life and background.
All right, so let's hear that cut.
I was born in New Orleans in 1939. For a short length of time during my childhood, I lived in Texas and in New York. During my junior high school days, I attended Beauregard Junior High School. I attended that school for 2 years. Then I went to Warren Eastern High School, and I attended that school for over a year. Then my family and I moved to Texas, where we have many relatives, and I continued my schooling there. Then I entered the United States Marine Corps in 1956. I spent 3 years in the United States Marine Corps, starting out as a private, working my way up through the ranks to the position of buck sergeant, and I served honorably, having been discharged. Then I went back to work in Texas, and have recently arrived in New Orleans with my family, with my wife and my child.
What do you think, Jeff?
It certainly sounded like in that clip he sounded almost determined, like he knew already what he was planning to do. Is that kind of how you feel also?
Well, you know, you can read Oswald different ways. One way, the obvious overt, if you will, a way to read him is that he was a kind of a determined, you know, sort of left-wing Marxist-type guy that wanted to be a street agitator and had plans for furthering his revolutionary ideas. But, of course, there's a whole other group of people who mirror-read Oswald as pretending to be a left-winger, pretending to be a Marxist, actually working for the CIA or some American intelligence outfit. But no matter which way you interpret it, yes, he does sound very determined. And you have to consider the way he sounds and appears this news film of him at the time also when you consider the assassination.
Do you think if he had never been killed almost right away after the assassination that we would actually find out more from him? Do you think he would have ever actually told the story?
Oh, sure. I mean, if you accept that he did it, and the forensic evidence is pretty strong that he did, if it's all genuine, we would have eventually found out what was going on, what had happened. But as somebody said recently in a documentary, I mean, the fact that Jack Ruby, 2 days after Oswald's arrest, shot him down in a police station, on TV actually at the time, forever closed the door to what might have motivated Oswald. You can only now look at his background and try to figure from looking at that what was going through his mind at the time.
I have to say is what they did back in that time where they kind of like trotted Oswald. They brought him out in front of the media, yeah. And how they kind of, I mean, that's unheard of in this day and age. And it, would it be fair to say, whether I'm asking Joe or asking you, Steve, do you think that's why we don't see this anymore where whoever the individual is who is the culprit is trotted out in front of the media?
Sure, and I think the Dallas police probably in retrospect looked back on that and thought they had goofed. Oswald had said to the press as he was being marched through the halls that the police had beat him or had hit him because he had marks on his face. So they wanted to bring him out and show that he wasn't being mistreated. They wanted to just bring him out there for a couple of seconds and show him. And the reporters asked him questions, and he said, yeah, he had been beaten by the police. So in order to placate the press, they wanted to, when they transferred him, which they were in the process of doing when he was shot, they wanted to do it in a public way. And they even told the press that if you're here by 10 o'clock, you'll see the transfer in the morning, which was probably a dumb thing to do in retrospect. But yeah, you wouldn't see that these days, probably because of what happened to Lee Harvey Oswald.
Now, where does David Ferry play into this? How does he come into this where they start looking at him? Who kind of turned, the police onto Mr. Ferry as to his background and how he might have somehow played a role in the assassination?
Well, the first time he emerged publicly was about 3 years after the assassination. The District Attorney of New Orleans, Jim Garrison, decided to take another look at the assassination in late 1966, early 1967. And one of the people that he started with was David Ferry, because there had been allegations pretty much from one guy who didn't like Ferry, that Ferry had had something to do with Oswald. And Garrison started to look into it. It came out in the press, one reason being that David Ferry himself called the press up and told them that he was their chief suspect. And then, strangely, right at the height of all the publicity about that, David Ferry was found dead in his apartment. And that, obviously, you know, people looked at that as, wow, you know, was he murdered? Was it a suicide? Turns out it was probably a stroke. But that was the thing that first burst him into public notoriety. And since that time, Ferry's been a fairly easy target for people to make allegations against. Although there are a couple of reasonably solid things about his background that make you wonder.
Was there any reason in particular that a New Orleans district attorney would be investigating rather than someone, say, in Houston?
Oswald, when he came back from the Soviet Union in 1962, initially settled in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, but then he came to New Orleans in April of 1963 and spent 3 or 4 months there. And again, doing some fairly unusual stuff, doing these demonstrations, passing out leaflets. And, you know, there was a very strong anti-Castro group in New Orleans at the time. And, you know, the last thing that a pro-Castro guy would want to do would be get in a scuffle with them. But Oswald invited a scuffle with some anti-Castro Cubans, and it caused him to be arrested and get a lot of publicity. And so, yeah, that was because of that activity in New Orleans. That's why Garrison wanted to look into it.
Now, I want to kind of set up. You were kind enough to give us another sound cut, this one of David Ferry. Kind of give us the background on this sound cut.
Now, this one is extremely rare. I don't think anybody in our listening audience has ever heard David Ferry's voice before. And it was very hard for me to find this. What had happened was that David Ferry was, prior to all of this Kennedy stuff, had had some arrests in New Orleans on morals charges. It turns out, since I've spoken to some of his alleged victims, that they were probably true, the charges were. But Ferry indicated to people that he thought he was being railroaded by the police and set up for an extortion, that if he only paid them $5,000, they would drop the charges and that sort of thing. And he got very paranoid about it. He thought they were trying to sabotage his plane and bug his telephones and that sort of thing. So this is a very weird David Ferry talking about the police conspiracy against him.
Okay, here it is.
On Saturday, August the 26th, that articles appeared in the New Orleans newspapers accusing me of many things, including enticing juveniles to immorality by a combination of alcohol, hypnotism, and aviation. I was charged with flying juveniles into Cuba and sundry other things. Two men, driving one New Orleans police car, came to my home one evening. I could not read badge numbers or get the names from the blue identification cards in time. They agreed to help frame me. They were given a variety of charges that they could pick from. Theft of an aircraft, jewel theft, armed robbery, dealing in contraband goods, dealing in contraband arms, illegal reentry into the United States from flights over Cuba. Since I have direct knowledge of how some of the killings have been engineered in New Orleans by New Orleans police, some unidentified policemen threatened to have me killed. In adding all of this data, I considered my situation both fantastic and hopeless. From this moment on, I have lived in terror and with fear that nothing can save me from these people. I then fled in fear of my life.
Well, I think you put it in the proper description. He sounds very paranoid in this sound cut.
He was a strange guy. He was very, very bright. He knew it. Everybody else knew it. And that was probably kind of his downfall in a lot of ways. He talked too much sometimes. And he did, in fact, actually, at one point, he was giving a speech to some anti-Castro people in New Orleans, and he was very upset about the Bay of Pigs invasion that had not been handled correctly by the United States. And he said something along the lines of, anybody that handled something so badly should be shot. And, of course, that's one of the things that came back to bite him on the butt years later.
I have to ask you, this is, how often did he and Oswald meet? Did they only meet that one time, or were there a number of meetings?
As far as we can tell, the only solid contact between the two of them was way back in the 1950s, 1955. Oswald was 15. He was in the Civil Air Patrol, and the instructor for that particular unit was David Ferry. So for several weeks, maybe 3-4 weeks, nobody's sure, they were in the same Civil Air Patrol unit. beyond that, there's nobody that's ever found any solid evidence that they knew each other. But there is one interesting little connection. David Ferry was working with an investigator and an attorney out of an office at a building at 531 Lafayette Street in New Orleans. At the same time, Oswald was handing out his leaflets. He had stamped those, Oswald had himself, with the address 544 Camp Street. That's the same building. It's two different entrances, and one goes upstairs and one goes downstairs. But it is interesting that this fellow that Ferry had known 8 years earlier as a boy was now using an address in the same building that Ferry was in that summer.
I have to ask, going back to Oswald, the day that he was killed, oddly enough, if you look at when he was killed approximately around the same time that the president was killed.
He was.
Right around 1 o'clock, 2 days later. Did they ever find out what was, when Jack Rubenstein was, when he basically killed Oswald, what the intent was behind it? Because there was a conspiracy built into that too, wasn't there?
Sure. Well, let me break it down again to what I mentioned, the lone nutters and the conspiracy theories. If you're a lone nutter, you accept Ruby's story that he told, that he just thought that Oswald had done a terrible thing, somebody needed to punish him. He didn't want to have a trial and have Mrs. Kennedy and the children have to come to Dallas to go to a trial. So he thought he was going to do the patriotic thing and kill this horrible assassin. That's one point of view. Another point of view is that Ruby himself was kind of a police character. He had a few kind of mob connections, nothing really major, but a few mob connections. And so, yeah, a lot of conspiracy theories have been built on that.
Did he ever, what happened with Jack Ruby? Did he go to trial? The folks who maybe didn't follow the whole story, did he go to jail? Did he ever confess why he did it?
Well, I just mentioned he said that he never testified at his trial.
Okay.
But he told people privately that that was the reason why he didn't want Mrs. Kennedy to have to come back, and he wanted to do what he thought everybody wanted to do, which is to kill Oswald. He went on trial in March 1964 in Dallas. He was found guilty because the evidence, of course, was videotapes of him doing it. He went to jail. I don't recall what the sentence was. It was, I don't think it was life, but it was a long sentence. And then about 3 years later, interestingly, just before Jim Garrison started his investigation, Jack Ruby passed away. And there are conflicting stories as to what he died from. Some say cancer, some say heart disease. It's not quite clear what he died of. Officially, it was cancer.
Watching some of the old video footage from back then, a lot of the folks thought that he was either a member of the press or he was a police officer. That's how he was able to kind of sneak in and basically, you know, put a bullet into the abdomen of Oswald.
Well, he was, like I say, he was a police character and kind of a media character. And he was, according to some people, pretending to be from a radio station. And he had a pad of paper and a pair of glasses, and he was pretending to take notes. Now, if you look at it conspiratorially, he was trying to get close to Oswald by pretending to be part of the press. But another point of view is he was another kind of crazy guy that got out of control and didn't know what he was doing. You and I are in media. We run across crazy people every once in a while.
What do you think is one of the least understood or most unknown facts about the assassination, or maybe most misinterpreted?
I look at the forensics, and I think that that's probably the thing that I think has been misinterpreted, in some cases sort of deliberately misinterpreted by people. As time goes by, you know, everybody's heard about cold cases and new technologies being applied to those. As time goes by, the technology gets better and better and better to try and resolve some of the mechanics, the ballistics of the shooting that have been debated for years. Was there the so-called single bullet theory? Why did the president's head go backward when he was shot and that sort of thing? And just a few days ago, I saw a documentary on TV where they had applied some incredible new laser and computer technology to it. And the famous single bullet theory, which is, takes a little time to explain, but what they said was that they showed you that the single bullet theory could have happened. Doesn't mean that it did happen, but it could have happened. So that's something that every time you read a book or see a documentary, they will debate. And I'll just do it really quickly in a nutshell. The Warren Commission said three shots were fired. One shot hit President Kennedy in the head. The other shot apparently missed the car. That means all of the other wounds had to come from another single bullet. And Arlen Specter, who passed away recently, Senator Arlen Specter, was on the Warren Commission at the time. And he devised the theory that one bullet must have passed through President Kennedy and hit Governor Connally, who was seated directly in front of him. Mm-hmm. And now through ballistics, as more and more time goes by, we get clearer and clearer versions of the original Zapruder film and things like that. It becomes more and more possible that, yes, Specter might have been right.
We had set things up by talking about you've been referenced in a lot of books. Of all the books that you've had a chance to, you know, read and look through that you're in, probably what are the compelling ones that you've had a chance to read? You like maybe where not only some of the information that was gathered and put together, but just how it was written.
I think one that people ought to look at is called Not in Your Lifetime. It's by an Irish-English author named Anthony Summers, who said some nice things about me on the internet recently.
Well, that helps.
I might add.
Yeah, that helps.
But he looks at the conspiracy theories, and he pays a lot of attention to them and comes up with a lot of original new information. But he's very cautious about it. That's the approach I like to see. There's an old kind of an axiom. It's an old Irish drinking thing. Where a person will go into a bar and they'll mark a bottle and they'll say, I'm going to drink this far and no farther. That's the way I feel about the evidence, is I want to theorize on the evidence only as far as the evidence allows and go no farther. A lot of people go way off into the stratosphere theorizing. But Anthony Summers is one of those, and I try to in the book that I'm working on in David Ferry, go as far as the evidence allows. And that's a good book. If you want to know like the official story, the Warren Commission Report is a good read. And there are a number of other books out there right now. There's actually hundreds, as I say right now, out there that you could pick up.
Now, you just said something very interesting, and I wasn't sure where to go with it because, again, I had a chance to speak with you before we went on air today, and that is that you are writing a book about David Ferry at this particular time.
I am, yes.
What finally motivated you to say, I have enough stuff that I have collected that I want to at least tell his story from the standpoint, instead of just being a snippet in someone's book, I want to kind of lay it out.
Well, the simple answer is computers and the internet. As I mentioned, I had been collecting stuff about David Ferry on index cards because I wanted to know for my own purposes what his involvement, if any, was. And then I came across a computer, and my mom helped me buy it back in the early 90s so I could use the word processor and maybe start to write it up a bit. Around that time is also when I met this fellow, Al Boboff, who knew a lot about Ferry because he was his best friend, introduced me to a lot of other people. So I started developing original new information as well. And a lot of documents started to become available from the National Archives and from other sources. But once I get onto the internet, I would write things about Ferry and people would come and question me. And I started getting approached by authors and documentary producers and that sort of thing. I get asked to speak at conferences about David Ferry. And so through the internet, I kind of have become an expert on David Ferry. If you look up David Ferry expert, you'll either see my name or my internet name, which is David Blackburst.
What's usually the frequently asked questions that you are asked? And I get also asked, is there a question that you wish that you were asked that you could at least give some kind of insight, not only about the Kennedy assassination, but also David Ferry?
The question that I'm asked all the time about Ferry is, was Ferry involved in the assassination? I don't have a simple, definitive answer. My gut feeling right now is that we have to consider the possibility that he was, but he also strenuously denied that he had anything to do with it, and he gave chapter and verse as to why. We also have to seriously consider the fact that it might have been misinterpreted information. I'm sorry, the second question was?
Is there a question that you wish that you were asked something that maybe nobody ever asked you about, that maybe this a factoid or something that's overlooked that you'd be willing to share that you just never been posed the question?
No specific question, but most of the books that come out now tend to focus on the conspiracy stuff, and I wish once in a while people would ask me, is it possible that Ferry might not have been guilty about this? Is there any information that indicates that he wasn't? Two things that come to mind were, on the two occasions when he was questioned about it by the authorities, he insisted on taking a lie detector test or sodium pentothal, and both cases that was not afforded to him. And maybe if that had been done, we might have had a better idea as to whether or not he was telling the truth when he said, I had nothing to do with this.
No, I believe that there might have been one or two movie depictions of David Ferry. Sure. How accurate are those? I think one of them is in the Kevin Costner JFK. Is that correct?
Yes. Some people think that it's a lot like Ferry. I look at it, you know, like a, almost like a scholar does. I sit there and I think, oh, this is interesting. This is cinematic and dramatic, but factually wrong. My big regret about the Oliver Stone movie, despite the fact that it was a marvelous piece of cinematography, was that there were a lot of misleading little things in it. Hmm. For example, Ferry is interviewed in the film by Jim Garrison. That never happened. Ferry said various things to Garrison during this interview, which I have the transcript of the actual interview with another district attorney, assistant district attorney. And Ferry never said those.
Wait. Are you saying filmmakers embellish things when they put together these big movies?
Well, Oliver Stone called it counter history. And we know Oliver Stone went out and did this series recently about his interpretation of American history. And he has an interesting, somewhat ideological look at history. Yeah.
Again, we have been speaking with Steve Roy, who is an expert in part of the area when it comes to the JFK assassination that took place, well, nearly 50 years ago. Later on this week, I believe, I want to say
Friday
will be the 50th anniversary. Mm-hmm. Of when one of our presidents was assassinated, the last president who was assassinated. I want to thank you for coming in. Anything you want to say as far as in closing in regards to this upcoming anniversary and as far as remembering JFK and all the facts surrounding the assassination?
No, I mean, President Kennedy was a very good president. He wasn't perfect, but he did some very nice things, and it's well to remember the positive things about his presidency. If one goes to look at the circumstances of his death, I hope people keep an open mind that there are people out there on both sides who really push their point of view. But keep an open mind, listen to both sides, and decide for yourself.
How many bad books have you come across? Without naming any names, how often have you come across a book and you're like, wow?
I will tell you really quickly about two. There's a book by a woman named Judith Baker who claims that she was Lee Harvey Oswald's mistress and knows all of the secrets of the assassination. And she does not like me because I've said to people her story is not true, and I know that it's not true. Right. And then there's another book that's come out recently that says that President Kennedy was not shot by somebody from a building, that a Secret Service man inadvertently discharged an AR-15 or whatever it's called, and by mistake shot President Kennedy in the head. All of the films and pictures say that that's baloney. That's not true. So avoid the baloney. And Jimmy Hoffa and Marilyn Monroe were not on the grassy knoll.
Okay. When do you hope to publish your book?
I was actually going to publish it this year. I was hoping to. But Judith Baker decided she's going to publish her biography of Oswald, and I don't want Ferry, and I don't want that coming out prior to her. So probably next year, maybe the year after.
Well, we'd love to have you back when you do release the book.
Absolutely.
And kind of talk about it in depth.
Absolutely.
All right.
It's been great.
We will step aside, and when we come back, we will speak with Junior D'Amato, your favorite guy.
My absolute favorite.
You are listening to Monday Night Talk. We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere.